Good evening. It's a great night to be a child of God, to rejoice and to be glad in it. Have you ever noticed how good the singing is on Sunday night? Just amazing. I know at least part of it is that the good singers are the ones that come back out Sunday night. I know also that the people who don't sing on Sunday mornings, their bodies absorb sound, so they actually become a sound sink. If you're in the auditorium and you're not singing, the singing would be better if you were not here. How's that for a terrible thought? Now, please don't anybody go home and say the preacher told me to go away, to go home and not come back. That's not what I mean. Your clothing absorbs sound. And if you're not singing, since you're absorbing sound instead of giving it out, you're, and some of us give out sound better than others, by the way, or more sound than others, then it really makes a difference. And I think that's one of the reasons it's so much better Sunday night. Plus, our voices have finally cleared up by Sunday night. And that helps too. Any song leader will tell you that the early service on Sunday morning is really hard on the voice. I was thinking as we were going through all those songs and how much I loved them and how much I appreciated it. And I love all the songs from old and new. I really do. There's not one category. As to me, it's the message. I mean, the tunes I like, but what's really important is the message. And one of the things that amazes me so much is how much. Have you ever stopped to think of how much and what exactly is taught in the songs? Chris Biddle showed, he's one of the deacons at Auburn Hills. Recently, he put me onto a website where this guy who is a worship leader, is just old enough to know everything. And he was railing against the songs in the hymn books and how we should never sing them and that we should just put the words on the screen and have a bunch of people with microphones so that everybody knows the parts. And he made a comment that really, and I kind of laughed off some of it. I thought, well, it's just the arrogance of youth because he hasn't been around that long. But then he made a comment, a derogatory comment about the hymns in our book. He said, I've sat in chapel in a Christian college and watched young people laugh at the songs we sing. And when I look at the teaching and the message in some of these songs, I thought, someone needs to be taught. Instead of asking, well, what kind of songs would you like to sing? Someone should sit down with people laughing at praise to God and say, let me talk to you about the message in this song. Which song were they laughing at? All to Jesus I surrender? I need thee every hour? Maybe they just haven't lived long enough to realize they need him every hour. When my love to Christ grows weak, on Zion's glorious summit, you know, which songs were they laughing at? Yes, and, you know, many of the quote, contemporary songs that are being sung, they all, you take about six different messages, and they all have that same message, sung four or five or six times over and over and over again. That's why a friend of mine calls them 7-11 songs, seven words sung 11 times. And some of them have a wonderful message, but it's kind of like dessert. Living on dessert. You can't live on dessert. I know some of our kids think they could, but you really can't. You need something a little more substantial. And I just appreciate the times when we can sing the way we have. That's the sermonette for the day. As you know, sermonettes are for Christianettes so they can get out early and smoke their cigarettes. But open your Bibles if you would. Yuck, yuck, yuck. That's line number 42. Okay. Open your Bibles, please, to John chapter 13. And verse 15. For I have given you an example that you should also do just as I have done to you. If I were to ask you to describe yourself in one word, one adjective, what would it be? You would say, I'm great. Fill in the blank. Most men, gorgeous. Oh, man. Brother Don is so humble. Well, he just hears it so much from his wife that it just naturally. Anyway, Most men would respond with their occupation, wouldn't they? I'm an engineer. You know, I'm a lawyer. I'm a preacher. You know, I'm a whatever. Most women probably would respond with something that had to do with relationships. I'm a homemaker. I'm a mother. I'm a grandmother, or whatever. There are literally dozens of possibilities. You know, you could respond with your political party. You could respond with your nationality. But very few people would respond the way the disciples of Jesus Christ learned to respond. If I were to ask you what is the one adjective that the apostles and writers of the New Testament introduced themselves with every single time, you probably wouldn't get it right. For example, so how did they introduce themselves? For example, they didn't. It wasn't Paul a disciple. It wasn't Peter a teacher. In every single case, the word was servant. Servant. Let me get this screen on. Well, this screen's not on, so I can't see what I'm doing. There we go. Now I can see. In every single case, the word was servant. Let me give you some examples. Romans 1:1. Paul, a servant of Jesus Christ, called to be an apostle. Philippians 1:1. Paul and Timothy, servants of Jesus Christ, to all the saints in Christ who are in Philippi and the bishops with the bishops and deacons. James 1:1. James, a servant of God and of the Lord Jesus Christ. 2 Peter chapter 1 and verse 1. Simon Peter, a servant and apostle. Note that he put servant before apostle. Most of us would have put apostle first, wouldn't we? Simon Peter, an apostle of Jesus Christ and a servant. Jude 1:1. Jude, a servant of Jesus Christ. Interesting. In fact, from Acts to Revelation, we're called Christians a grand total of 3 times. We're called disciples 27 times, and we're called, 27, and we're called servants 103 times. Let me run through those numbers for you again. And I'll throw in believers too. We're called Christians 3 times, believers 4 times, disciples 27 times, and servants 103 times. Do you get the idea that in the eyes of Christ and of God, and in the eyes of the inspired writers, one of the greatest things they could refer to themselves as was servants? What does it tell us? That they considered their status as servants to be one of the most important aspects of who they were. In the years following the death and the resurrection of Jesus Christ, these people understood the importance of being a servant. Does that really surprise you? Probably it does. Does it seem like a good thing? You know, there is a training program that's world famous in one of the large hotel chains in New York. And in this, one of the finest hotels in the world, they emphasize outstanding service provided to the guest by every member of the staff, from the front desk to the maids to the bellboys. But I'll never forget this one line that they used in their training. The line was, "You are not servants, you are ladies and gentlemen serving ladies and gentlemen." What does that tell you about how we feel about the word servant? You know, because when they hear the word servant, they think someone that's stooping and bowing and scraping to someone that's superior to them or thinks they're superior to them. One of the finest illustrations of servanthood is here in John chapter 13. And we're going to take a few minutes this evening and look over this example of how to serve like Jesus served. Because after all, he did say in verse 15, "I have given you an example that you also should do just as I have done to you." And what he had done was to serve. When we look at John chapter 13, it says, beginning in verse 13, "Now before the feast of the Passover, when Jesus knew that his hour had come to depart out of this world to the Father, having loved his own who were in the world, he loved them to the end. During supper, when the devil had already put it into the heart of Judas Iscariot, Simon's son, to betray him, Jesus, knowing that the Father had given all things into his hand and that he had come from God and was going back to God, rose up from supper, laid aside his garments, and taking a towel, tied it around his waist. Then he poured water in a basin and began to wash the disciples' feet and to wipe them with the towel that he had wrapped around it. When you look at this example, you have to understand the setting. Most of you do that have been Bible students for a while, but perhaps you're new to the Bible and you really can't picture the setting of what's going on here. Something fascinating has happened. Somebody has slipped up and is not willing to admit it and cover for their mistake. Because back in the Gospel of Luke, we're told that the day before, Jesus had called on two of his trustiest disciples here in Luke 22, and he said to Peter and John, go and prepare the Passover for us that we may eat it. And you recall last week, he said, you'll go into town and you'll see this guy carrying a jar, which men never do, and you'll follow him right into the house, and even though there shouldn't be a room left in Jerusalem for the Passover, his master is going to have a room all prepared for you, and then you go up and make preparations. So apparently they had to go out and get the lamb and make sure that somebody roasted it and the bitter herbs and the unleavened bread and the cups and the wine and everything. But in the process, they forgot one thing. The streets of Jerusalem, the streets of Palestine in general, the streets anywhere in ancient times were not like our streets. Of course, the streets in Michigan are starting to look more like them these days, as you all know. I wonder how you did a front-end alignment on a chariot. But these streets are muddy. And to make matters worse, the first thing that would happen in the morning was the chamber pots and the stuff that was left over from the night before, on many of these streets, it was just pitched right into the center of the street. And on many of these streets, the sewer system was an open ditch that ran down the center of the street. Everybody's wearing wearing sandals, and the feet by the end of the day would have been incredibly dirty. When I was in Russia on three different occasions, many women carried a little set of socks or something in their purse, because when you went into someone's flat, you always took your shoes off. You never left your shoes on when you went into someone's flat. You say, well, that must have been a cut. Oh, no. They didn't want you, after walking the streets in Russia, they didn't want those shoes walking on their floors. Now, sometimes you looked at the floor and you thought, well, I don't know how that's worse. But still, you never did it. And many times you go in and the women would open their purses and out would come these little footies and put them on. And of course, we men, we didn't have purses to carry footies in. But so in Jerusalem at that time, you would have never walked into a room with your shoes on. And the feet would have been just incredibly filthy. And so the normal practice was that when you went into a room, a servant, when you entered the house, one of the first things that would happen was that a servant would wash your feet. If there was no servant, the lowest ranking person in the room would wash your feet. Now that's where the problem comes in for the disciples in John chapter 13. Peter and John apparently realize, either they were oblivious and didn't realize it because their wives weren't there to tell them, or they knew and weren't willing to come clean on it. They walk into the room and nobody has washed anybody's feet. They've all taken their sandals off at the door, but here's the real problem with not washing their feet. They're not sitting. You know, Leonardo da Vinci really didn't get it right when he shows everybody at the at the Last Supper, sitting in straight New England ladder-backed chairs, smiling for the camera. You know, that wasn't the way it was. You had a U-shaped or a table that was rectangular or square shape, and everybody reclined on their left elbow at a 45-degree angle from the table, and you reclined at your left elbow and you ate with your right hand, which meant that your feet were behind the head of the person eating in front of you. Ew. I mean, some people don't need sandals for their feet to smell, but imagine what it must have smelled like to have these filthy feet that have been walking the dung-infested streets. And Peter and John had forgotten to arrange for a servant to wash feet. And finally, Jesus steps forward. And we learn some lessons about real servanthood in this story. First is, to be a real servant, you must know who you are. Notice in chapter 13 again what it says. The hour had come, he says in verse 2, during supper, when the devil had already put it into the heart of Judas Iscariot, Simon's son, to betray him, Jesus, knowing that the Father had given all things into his hand, and that he had come from God and was going to God, comma, rose from supper, laid aside his outer garments, taking a towel, tied it around his waist. Jesus was the only one in the room willing to serve because he was the only one in the room that knew who he was. You know, that statement by the folks, the trainers back there in that famous hotel is actually illogical. Think about the statement. You are not servants. You are, ladies and gentlemen, serving, ladies and gentlemen. Excuse me, what is a servant but someone who serves? The statement is illogical. And the way it should have been presented is this. Because you are ladies and gentlemen, you shouldn't be afraid of serving other ladies and gentlemen. You should be able to serve because you know who you are. The reason no one else in the room was willing to wash the disciples' feet is because they're, according to Luke, they're worried and concerned about who's going to be first in the kingdom. If I get up and wash somebody's feet, then they'll know I'm not first. Well, they haven't been listening to Jesus for the last 3 years, have they? And so we have to understand this, that authentic servanthood is couched first in knowing that you are a child of God. Matthew 25:23, his master said to him, "Well done, good and faithful servant. You have been faithful over a little. I will set you over much. Enter into the joy of your master." You know, see, to the apostles, they were willing to put that word servant first. Paul, a servant of the Lord Jesus Christ and an apostle, because they knew servants of the God of the universe. I'm a child of God. What more could I want? I'm a child of the King. And so once we're secure in who we really are, we don't have to prove who we are to the people around us. Secondly, authentic servanthood is proactive. And by that I mean it seeks opportunities to serve other people. Looking for opportunities. You're sitting in a fellowship meal and you notice there aren't enough tables. And you say to your wife, you know, someone didn't set up enough tables. You know, we need to find out who that was and make sure they get their act together. No. Authentic servanthood says, oh boy, this is an opportunity for me to serve everybody. Wonder where the tables are. Or, now let's really get uncomfortable. Authentic servanthood, you're walking through the house. Are we getting uncomfortable now? See, it's one thing to talk about service at church before meals. And you notice that your mate's had a really stressful day and is kind of overloaded. And you're on your way in. I mean, you've worked hard all day too. And I mean, you've earned your station as a couch potato. And instead, you don't really want to do it, but you just stop and you put her hand on her shoulder and say, "Honey, is there something I can do to help?" And you say it like you actually mean it. Or you're walking through the laundry room and you notice all of these dirty clothes and you just scoop them up. And you know that commercial that we all hate from JCPenney's where the women are yelling, "No!" And you scoop them up and your wife yells, "No! Please don't wash the clothes. I don't want pink socks." No, I'm just teasing, but you understand that real servanthood is not something that happens just in the church building where everybody sees. I mean, let's be honest. I mean, when you do get up and you do roll those tables out and start setting them up without being told, you know in your heart of hearts somebody's going to see and say, "Well, at least he was willing to get up and do them." But when you serve at home, nobody sees except the Lord. When you serve in the neighborhood and you see an elderly person, and you know those elderly people, you know, they're just getting older and older. I've just noticed There was a time when 60 was old. Did you know that? And you see this elderly person shoveling the sidewalk, and you've got a shovel, and you're warm and comfy, an opportunity to serve. You see, Jesus saw that the disciples' feet were unwashed. I don't know if the other disciples just didn't notice or they were afraid to admit it and take a position as a servant, but real servants are proactive. And thirdly, real servants, real service is unannounced. You know, Jesus didn't stand up and say, "All right, everybody, I want you to notice what's about to happen here. Y'all should be ashamed of yourselves because we're in here and nobody's washed anybody's feet. And I'm going to show you what to do and how to do it and to do it right." No, he just got up and he did it. Real service is unannounced. It doesn't do it to seek glory. You don't run up a flag and start telling everybody, "Everybody look this way, see what I'm doing." And then the problem with that is if nobody notices, you quit doing it, don't you? This act was instigated because Jesus saw a need and he fulfilled it. In Luke 22:24, a dispute also arose among them as to which of them was to be regarded as the greatest. And he said to them, "The kings and the Gentiles exercise lordship over them. Those in authority over them are called benefactors, but not so with you. Rather, let the greatest among you become as the youngest, and the leader is the one who serves. For who is greater, the one who reclines at table or the one who serves? Is it not the one who reclines at table? But I am among you as one who serves." Luke says what instigated this was not just that their feet were dirty, but that they were arguing over who was going to be first in the kingdom. So it's proactive, and real service is unannounced. When you serve like Jesus, also, here's another one. Not only are you able to serve, but you're able to receive service. Do you know some people can't receive service? Read on in the account with me if you would. He says in verse 5, "Then he poured water into the basin and began to wash the disciples' feet and wiped them with a towel that was wrapped around his waist." The towel wrapped around his waist was the act of a servant, by the way. "And he came to Simon Peter and said to him, 'Lord, do you wash my feet?' Jesus answered him, 'What I'm doing, you do not understand.'" You know, as usual, Peter doesn't have a clue. "But afterwards you will understand." And Peter said, "You shall never wash my feet." Why would Peter not want him to wash his feet? Pride. In the Jewish culture, according to the book, The History of the Audience of Jesus, a book written by a historian, not by a theologian, who just went back and studied the culture, then looked at the New Testament, and how does that fit? He said one of the unusual features of Jewish culture in the first century was that they had a difficult time receiving gifts. They didn't want to be given anything because in their minds they were now obligated to give something back that was worth exactly $1 more. And then that just repeated the cycle. And here's Peter. And what's he saying? Have you ever been at dinner with someone? You're eating out, and the woman comes up and she's taking your orders and she asks you, "Will this be separate checks?" And you say, "No, just one." Have you ever been with someone that just threw a fit and couldn't deal with that? What's that all about? Pride. If you're one of those people, and I have to admit, you know, I won't say, "Oh no, no, do this." If you're at dinner and someone says, "Just one check, do this," say, "Well, thank you." Don't even say, "I'll get you the next time." For a while, I would make it a joke. I would say, "Okay, I wish I'd have known because I'd have ordered something more expensive, you know. But if you want to do that, do that. But whatever you do, just say thank you. Don't make an issue out of it." I'll tell you a case where Tom and I, we've talked about this, and it was a problem for us when we first started preaching. And you did a funeral, and someone handed you an envelope. It does, sometimes this happens. And you open it up, and there was a nice card and some money in it. And I knew a preacher who always refused to take the money. And I thought, I can't do this. I didn't do this for money. And then I thought, wait a minute. If someone had just performed a funeral for my loved one, what would I want to do? And if I did and they threw it back in my face, how would that make me feel? So if someone hands me an envelope, I just say thank you. If they don't hand me an envelope, that's fine. It's the same way with weddings. You know, someone hands you an envelope, you say thank you. If they don't hand you an envelope, you say, you know, that's fine. And so Peter has a problem. He's not able to receive. And let's notice that he continues. Dear old Peter is usually the case. He said to him, Lord, not my feet only, but my hands and my head. Jesus said to him, the one who is bathed doesn't need to wash except his feet, but is completely clean. And you are clean, but not every one of you, for he knew who was to betray him. And that was why he said, not all of you are clean. And when he'd washed his feet and put on his outer garments, he resumed his place and said, do you understand what I have done to you? You call me teacher and Lord. Lord, master. And you're right, for so I am. You see, once again, that comes back to the first point, doesn't it? Jesus was able to wash their feet because he knew who he was. He didn't have to prove anything to anybody. If I then, your Lord, that's master, and teacher, have washed your feet, you also ought to wash one another's feet. For I've given you an example. Also, you should do as I have done to you. So he's saying we're commanded to wash people's feet. Now, I do have to throw this out. There are a couple of churches that believe that washing feet is part of the Lord's Supper. This passage does not, but my answer to that is this. This passage does not connect washing feet with the Lord's Supper. And we have no example in the New Testament of it being attached to the Lord's Supper. It happened in the same room, but so did the Passover. And we don't associate and we don't observe the Passover when we take the Lord's Supper. The only reference I can find in the New Testament, once the church had been established, to washing the feet is found in 1 Timothy chapter 5, where it's an act of hospitality. Women who were taken onto the church role for support, it said, if they have shown hospitality, if they have washed the disciples' feet. And that was a reference to something that happened in the home, not in a worship service. And another answer to those who would say washing feet is an act of worship would be this. Jesus said, the reason I'm washing your feet is because they are. Most people today wear socks and shoes when they come to church and their feet are not dirty. As a matter of fact, I've talked to a preacher who practices washing feet on the rare occasions when they have communion. And they don't actually wash feet, they wash foot. And they don't actually wash the foot, they dab water on it. And the foot is not dirty, since the people knew they were going to have their feet washed that morning, and so they wouldn't be embarrassed, they washed their feet before they came. And so Jesus said, I'm washing your feet because they're dirty. Well, that doesn't apply when people wash their feet and come to church and take their shoe and sock off and let you dab water on the top of their foot. What he's saying is, when you see a need, fill it if you have the opportunity. Authentic servants, and finally, real, when we serve like Jesus, we don't expect reciprocity. You can finish the sentence for me. I'll serve you if you
serve me.
Uh-huh. Yep. I'll serve you if I get recognized. I'll serve you if someone praises me. In one of the churches I grew up in, when they had something go on where a lot of people were involved, they would never recognize anybody by name for fear of leaving out someone's name. What does that tell you? I mean, do the best you can. If people are serving, after all, people are serving for the right reason. If you forget their name or you leave it out or you mispronounce it or misspell it, they understand. And if you accidentally leave someone's name out and they get all upset, maybe that's a teaching opportunity. But don't fail to recognize people for fear that someone's name will be left out. Now, don't serve to be recognized, but we certainly should honor those who serve. Give honor to whom honor is due. Romans 1:1 again. Paul, a servant of Jesus Christ, called to be an apostle, separated from the gospel. Do you serve like Jesus? Oh, yes. I'm a deacon. I'm an elder. I'm a preacher. I'm a song leader. I set up tables. Okay, that's wonderful, and I'm glad you do. But do you serve like Jesus at home? Do you serve like Jesus at work? Do you serve like Jesus in your local community? Just some thoughts to share with you to think about as we stand for the invitation song now.